This is the AI Health Podcast, where we explore the ways in which AI will transform healthcare, biotech, and medicine through conversations with entrepreneurs, investors, and scientists.
Hey, I'm your co-host, Pranav Rajpurkar.
And I'm Adrielle Saporta.
And you're listening to the AI Health Podcast. Today, we're going to chat with Professor Susan Athey, the economics of technology professor at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. She's the founding director of the Golub Capital Social Impact Lab and associate director of the Stanford Institute for Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence. She previously served as consulting chief economist for Microsoft for 6 years.
Our conversation with Professor Athey today will cover a really broad range of important topics for understanding how AI has already changed and will further change the economy. And an especially important topic we'll discuss is what can be done to encourage the development of fair and ethical AI.
Yeah, I was thinking we could start our show today by diving a little bit into fair AI. And we'll be making some simplifications here in our explanations, but I think we'll get the higher level point across.
Awesome. All right, let's get started.
Okay, so let's start with the first possible criteria for fair, which is called independence. So let's say we have two groups of people that we're interested in, say California residents with cancer and Kansas residents with cancer. And let's say we've developed a novel therapy for cancer and we want to find candidates that seem most likely to benefit from it. It might seem reasonable to want California and Kansas cancer patients to be recommended for this drug with equal percentages.
Okay, so that makes sense. So in order to satisfy this independence criteria, if 10% of California residents with this condition are recommended for this new treatment, then 10% of Kansas residents should be too.
Exactly. And so you might notice that there are some assumptions that should be satisfied for this metric to be useful. So we might assume that biologically or environmentally, the chance that California residents respond to our therapy is about the same as for our Kansas residents.
Is there anything that could go wrong here if we're building AI?
Yeah. So say we have a lot more data from California than from Kansas. Then the AI that is making recommendations for Kansas might be quite a lot worse than the one for California. And so when we enroll everyone in this clinical trial that we're applying this AI to, it might seem like Kansas residents are responding worse to our therapy. So even though we tried to give the Kansas residents an equal shot at improved outcomes, we ultimately would not have succeeded.
Right. So is there a way that we could define fairness as giving Kansas residents an equal shot, given that our algorithm recommended them for treatment?
Yeah, so we can have a second possible criteria for fairness called sufficiency. And in a simplified way, this says if the AI recommends treatment for a California resident, and let's say it has a 20% chance of being successful, then we would like it to also have a 20% chance of success for a Kansas resident.
Okay, so what would you have to do to make an algorithm actually behave like that?
Well, one way would be to use different thresholds for each of these subgroups. And when I say subgroups, I mean California residents or Kansas residents. So when we formulate classification problems in machine learning, our AI will output some score between 0 and 1 that we hope indicates something like the confidence that the treatment will work. So 0 would mean it would most certainly not work. 1 would mean it most certainly would.
Okay, so I feel like I know where you're going with this. We ultimately have to choose some cutoff or threshold, say 0.8. And then anyone with a score above 0.8 will be recommended for treatment, and anyone below 0.8 won't be recommended for treatment. And so if we have different cutoffs for different subgroups, we should be able to satisfy this criteria.
Yeah. So in theory, we could make the cutoffs for the California residents, let's say 0.8, but the algorithm cutoff for Kansas residents, a different one, like 0.7. And that way, we've basically forced the algorithm to be more confident for one group to offset the fact that its confidence scores might be more or less accurate. But now, by satisfying this new condition, we might have violated the independence criteria that we had said that we wanted before, where we said 10% of Kansas residents would be recommended treatment, 10% of California residents would be recommended treatment. And which one of these two criteria is better could involve quite a bit of legality and ethics that is specific to the actual use case of the algorithm.
Got it. Okay. And so what about the case where we want to be fair to both groups and we want to explicitly account for the fact that we expect a different prevalence responding to our therapy in each group?
Right. And this is a pretty common situation to find ourselves in. And so this third possible criteria for fairness is called separation. So let's use a different example that will be a little simpler for this case. Let's say we have two groups, say white Americans and Black Americans. Of course, race isn't binary like this, but we want to make this example simple. So let's say we have an algorithm that diagnoses diabetes. And we know that Black Americans are more likely to have diabetes than white Americans. And so what do we want with our separation criteria? We want that given a patient does in fact have diabetes, we will require that our algorithm diagnose a patient with diabetes with equal likelihood in both a white American and a Black American. Or given that a patient does not in fact have diabetes, we will require that the algorithm diagnose the patient with not having diabetes with equal likelihood in both white American and Black Americans.
Cool. So it sounds like each of these criteria have different pros and cons, and this is just scratching the surface, obviously.
Yeah, there's a lot more to learn here, and we are very much scratching the surface of fair AI here.
Great. Well, I'm excited to zoom back out a bit and talk with Professor Athey about AI's impact a lot more broadly.
Thank you for being on the show with us, Susan.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start our chat today by talking about the impact of AI on the economy. There are complex ways in which AI will affect the economy. You've described the impact on labor markets and consumer demand through the development of AI to substitute or complement workers. You've described the impact on industry structure and prices. I want to start by asking you, how far are we in 2021 in terms of seeing the impact of the investments in AI and automation to market conditions?
I think it really depends on where you sit in the economy. We're a lot further along now than we were 2 years ago. Because to really get AI to work, there's sort of this, I don't know, crawl, walk, run thing that you have to have data. And so if you're providing a service, a government service or a consumer service, you not just have to have a little bit of data, you have to have a fair bit of data. And the more advanced forms of AI, you really need to be able to interact with your environment. You know, you need to be able to make decisions based on this data, maybe in an automated or semi-automated way, whether it's responding to the individual consumer and providing them the customized service to them, learning on the fly how to interact with a consumer. And generally, even if you're doing something that's more static, like doing some kind of image recognition, still the models can get better and better, and you want to be able to change them. So there's actually a lot of infrastructure that needs to be in place, not just having data, but having access to data and having an engineering situation where you can iteratively improve. And frankly, even medium-sized tech firms, even advanced tech firms, are often not all the way to that level of sophistication in all of their services. Like in some parts they are, but in other parts they're still pretty backwards and pretty manual and doing everything based on heuristics. So, you know, there was a lot of infrastructure to be able to get the real benefits. And historically, that infrastructure was only in place really in a few places in the economy. But what's happened in the last 2 years is that firms that were like on the margin of like, do I need to have an in-person call center or, you know, can I automate some of this stuff? Should we make all the doctors learn how to do telemedicine? All sorts of other things. So we got collectively a big chunk of the economy like over a bunch of hurdles that were like fixed cost investments that people might have been putting off. So I feel like we may have gotten to a step change in terms of the growth process coming out of all of this.
So now we're building the infrastructure. Let's say we have the data and we have this digitization going on. Do you see a world in which automation and AI starts getting applied to the small tasks first and then incrementally to larger and larger tasks? Or do you think there's also space here for building something that basically says everything that's in the regime of someone's set of tasks, I'm going to entirely automate with AI?
The second one of like, I'm going to have a general purpose AI that does everything, really far away from that. If you think about the search business, where I was chief economist of Microsoft for about 6 years, and I spent a lot of time on the search engine, that's where I learned about AI to start with in the late 2000s. Where was it really hard to compete? Like, basically, you know, it's not just that Microsoft wasn't good at it or something, right? Like, search is hugely profitable all over the world. If anybody thought they could be good at search, like, they should have wanted to go and challenge Google. And basically, there's just a couple search engines in the world. And, you know, it's been really difficult for anybody to get traction. Now, in specialized search, like shopping or travel or restaurant reviews or anything, actually, many firms provided much better service than Google did in those specialized areas where the problems were more structured. But one of the things that's really hard about search is like people could be saying anything. You can't really narrow down the user interface very well because there's so many different modalities. And when the problem space is so big, there's just so many ways you can get things wrong and misinterpret things. And even in the end, like you sort of think of a general search engine as being one big algorithm, but it's totally not. You know, it's everything is distributed. First, you classify like what kind of thing is this user doing? And then you have specialized algorithms and specialized content feeds that are separately tuned. And really, even the general AI that we're familiar with is actually piecing together a bunch of specialized AI. The ways in which AI have advanced, in my view, are much more on simple tasks. And occasionally we've done this magic of like turning something that seems really hard into several simple tasks and it actually works. But that's kind of rare, actually, that you can really solve the whole problem. Most cases, it's too complex and the quality is just not good enough to try to do everything.
Is the case that in some labor markets, the adoption of AI is seen to be quicker or better incentivized than others?
So one of the things that people are concerned about is robots are going to take all of our jobs. So actually, maybe let me circle back to your last question, which was about whether we were having this general AI. So my answer was sort of no. And I guess part of that was that where we've gotten really, really good is in automating prediction problems. And the reason it works well is because there's a ground truth. And so the robot itself can check how well they do because the problem is simple enough that I can test whether I've solved it in a test data set. So anything that is a problem where I can check how well I've done it in a test data set is very well suited to be sent off to a robotic research assistant to solve. I don't want to minimize that there are actually cases where you can do something pretty magical by decomposing a problem into a set of prediction problems and solving them. But roughly, that's what we've gotten good at. So that's like pieces of jobs, you know, that's like an assistant to a decision maker. But then there's all these edge cases and the world is more complex and there's many parts of jobs that where you don't know whether you did it right immediately. And it's not even knowable whether you did it right immediately, or you have to contemplate new situations all the time that are out of the realm of what it would be easy to train on. So those are the circumstances that I think are much harder. And that's why I think it's not the right way to think about it. It's just that the robots are taking over all these general jobs. It's more that they're just eating away around the edges, automating piece and piece and piece and piece after each other. But then when we talk about like, how is this going into the economy? Well, there are places like, say, call centers where we've seen this. It was already happening. A lot of the banks were already outsourcing because people were using apps. Well, the apps aren't really AI. The apps are just apps. But in the end, when people can get their needs met through simple automation, then you don't need the call center as much. And then you add just pretty simple AI on top of things. And then suddenly you've killed more of the call center. So there's still exceptions left and you need people in the call center, but you just don't need very many people in the call center because most of the stuff is happening self-service. But because those services are provided in the cloud often, like a lot of the software is provided in the cloud and you can kind of buy it off the shelf and it's something really similar that lots of different companies can use. I feel like that kind of can roll through really quickly and kill a lot of jobs and cause a fair bit of disruption for people. But then there's other places where I don't think that disruption happens so quickly because there's not like this one replicable job where you can just build software as a service at scale and like refine it in a way that's going to, you know, have such rapid impact.
What's an example from history where technology sort of just like wiped out jobs in a very quick way? Is there sort of like an example that you were an analog from, you know, 50, 100 years ago that you look at when you think about, okay, AI will kind of probably follow this pattern?
I think Eric Bernolfsson, my colleague, is the one who's done a lot of writing about this topic. But, you know, my reading of his writing is that when you go back in time, actually, most of these transformations happen slowly, very slowly. So there aren't a lot of examples where transformations happened super quickly. You know, of course, there's jobs that have been wiped, like the elevator operator gets wiped out. But then actually the elevator operator maybe was doing other things too. So you still have a doorman or a lobby person.
Yeah.
So you don't need as many staff perhaps, but you still have other tasks that are done by people. But things like electrification, which was of course incredibly transformative, it was still like took decades because each factory had to retool.
Yeah.
And that has gone slowly through the economy in a lot of ways. But I think the customer service centers is one of these examples where it's not as complicated necessarily to retool. And, you know, you can kind of buy it in a box. And actually, human customer service wasn't all that great anyways. And so customers kind of like the other thing better. So it wasn't that hard to just go from, you know, to say, oh, we need a lot of these people, to saying, actually, we don't really need very many of those people. That actually has happened pretty fast. And one of the reasons I focus on them is that people were going around putting call centers in economically depressed places. So, you know, you might have had a place that used to do coal mining, and then they stopped having coal mining, and then a bank put in a call center there. And then when you kill the call center, like these were pretty bleak places to start with. That's why they went there, because they had low wages. You really can get sort of local macroeconomic spirals down. And I think we should be concerned about those in those sort of very specific areas. But generally, it's like you see, oh, well, you know, there was a search engine and it magically brought me stuff. So therefore, tomorrow, everything else is going to go just as quickly. But then,
right.
You know, yeah. A lot of this other stuff has gone really slowly.
So you mentioned that we're at a turning point in terms of sort of AI adoption in industry. And I can't help but feel like it's been slower than we expected. And I think my go-to way of thinking about this is that maybe certain sectors are just going to be the first movers. Like we're just going to see that retail is going to move faster than power plants are going to move, or healthcare, for example. But just going through our conversation so far, I'm wondering if actually maybe it's really application specific. So like you're mentioning call centers, or, you know, there's maybe a specific small application of AI that many different sectors are all going to be able to implement, whether it's banks, retail, whoever it may be. And I shouldn't be thinking about it on a sector by sector basis.
Yeah, I do think that's right. I mean, the industry structure of all of this you're kind of hinting at is actually pretty interesting, because when I first saw search and I saw how expensive it was for Microsoft to develop all the algorithms for its search engine, I thought, wow, like we're just going to have a bunch of big companies and this is going to be a disaster for the economy. And the really cool thing that happened, and there's a bunch of reasons why this happened, but in the end, like we saw just this massive explosion of open source software, so that a lot of the things that Microsoft spent hundreds of millions of dollars to develop, actually now you can just get them for nothing. Like I think I got a couple terabytes of data, of GPS data at some point. And I was thinking like, wow, like at Microsoft, it would have cost $1 million to analyze this data basically, because I would have had to spin up a team and write all the code. And then, you know, I just put it up on the cloud and used other people's software. A lot of the distribution of the computing has like automated for me. You know, people had figured out the best ways to parallelize. I didn't have to use my brain to try to figure out how to parallelize stuff, right? So it was all like just boom. I could just analyze it, like, and I could pay, yeah, you know, a couple $100s to store it for a few months, and I could rent some computers, and I was good. So that's a real. That was just something that was not obvious to me in 2008, although later by 2010 and 11, I started working in the cloud, I started thinking about it. So that changed industry structure a lot. And I think looking back at it, there's two things. One is that actually AWS and Microsoft and Google are all trying to get people onto their cloud. So they gave away a lot of stuff for free to try to just get people onto their cloud, because there's actually scale economies in the cloud. So that was something that people just gave things away. But then also that there were more companies in the end that wanted to use this general purpose AI. And so then it kind of got democratized in this way. Mm-hmm. So it's still the case that general search has tons of proprietary stuff and you still can't easily build a general search engine. But along the way, a lot of the machine learning algorithms and stuff like that all got democratized. You know, Facebook pre-trains the neural nets for image recognition. So that means that actually the barriers to entry are low. And even like companies don't even have to train their own image recognition neural nets. They can just like download Facebook's or whatever.
So, or does it mean that the barrier to entry is now data as opposed to being the models themselves, right? Like if you're collecting a ton of search data, then your search algorithm is going to be a little bit better.
I would say it's data, but it's also users. And I think people fail to appreciate that from the outside sometimes, because what you need to do is you need to be able to interact with your users. You need to be able to experiment on your users. Historical logged data can be really hard to use because you don't know why different people saw different things. And it probably was not purely random in general. But if you ran experiments in the past and you save the right information to analyze it, that's very helpful. What's even more helpful is just to be able to constantly experiment and get better. I feel like the algorithms are not really the thing. It's the experience. The algorithms are a commodity, but it's the experience of knowing how to use them most efficiently and effectively and how to innovate on them, how to measure their success. Finding the right measures of success, the right KPIs, metrics to optimize for, that is actually the most common problem companies bring to me. They're like, okay, we want to get more automated. We want our A/B testing to be better, but we realize that we're optimizing for clicks, or you know, we're optimizing for some short-term thing. We're optimizing for minutes used, and that's not our goal. But if we want to let the AI loose on something and have it, it's got to optimize something. But if it's optimizing the wrong thing, you end up sort of like the YouTube story where people are getting polarized and you know, radicalized, right? And that's what happens when you optimize the wrong thing.
I want to ask about that a little bit more. You presented a framework on the economics of beneficial artificial intelligence, and I just wanted to dive into the buckets. So one of the buckets here is that the development of AI is endogenous, that it's not some pre-specified path that we're all going down. Instead, it's about responding to incentives. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So today, like we've seen this massive innovation in things that companies have needed to do. And then, like I said, for some of these, the companies just gave it away because they decided that wasn't their strategic advantage. So image recognition, you know, there's lots of commercial applications. People have got good at that. And then on the manufacturing side, you know, there's obviously clear profit incentives to automate. So when industry is doing most of the innovation we will get is what the profit motive motivates. And, you know, occasionally you get lucky and they give a lot of it away, which is great, but you know, you can't really count on that. And then they're not always incentivized, even like within the things that they're doing, until it's maybe too late. They don't put enough effort into thinking about what are the safety implications, or they think of themselves as like being small in the world, but they don't think about in aggregate, if we're all adopting these algorithms, you know, what are the biases that arise, or what are the unforeseen consequences? You know, how does it affect elections and democracy and people's digital addiction and their happiness and well-being? These are just things that they're hard. Of course, they're hard. And, you know, really, what do you expect, right? Do you expect some person who just got their PhD from Stanford and studied how to download data sets and train neural nets? Like, how are they supposed to know how tweaking their model to make it a little bit better is going to change well-being, right? These aren't things that we're training people for. Consumers want it, but yet they don't really respond to these things very much in their choice behavior. So even when companies try to be better, they don't really get rewarded for it in the market. So that's where I think the universities can come in. We have this institute at Stanford, the Institute for Human-Centered Artificial Intelligence, which is a big thing. And then I have a lab that I'm running, which is a medium-sized thing. And I think both of them share one of these theses that universities can play a really crucial role. We can choose to require students to get a broader education. You know, we can teach them not just the tools to make great neural nets, but also the tools to evaluate them. And we can teach them about equilibria and unintended consequences. And we can teach them about fairness. We can teach them philosophy and ethics. So we can give them frameworks so that when they go in, they're not just feeling vaguely uncomfortable, but that they can actually take a more scientific and rigorous approach. And my observation is that, you know, mostly engineers want to do good. Like, people don't want to work for a firm that's hurting the world. That's just not what young people want. But they'll do it by accident. And if they're not specifically rewarded to not do it, and they don't really know how to not do it, then they can still cause harm.
Do you think that the engineering students have been more or less or equally receptive to this type of new, maybe ethical training than the business students?
I think the engineers are actually like they're builders and they are kind of tend to be techno-optimists. And so they feel like their job is to go fix, they want to fix problems, not cause problems. So I think there is something just like deeply embedded in most engineers that they like building stuff that works. And if it causes problems, that means it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So that's aesthetically unpleasing. It just doesn't sit right. But they're also kind of scientific and process oriented. And so if there's no framework to resolve these problems, then it's like they just get ignored. So that's why I actually truly believe that there can be an outsized impact of a little bit of education, because my experience in the business world and in teaching is that when you give people the framework and the tools, they want to use them. You know, an engineer doesn't want to be responsible for causing discrimination or not causing discrimination. If there's like a paper somebody's written, if it's been written out clearly, what are the best practices? Like they want to adopt best practices. That covers their butt and that makes sure that they build things that actually work. So there's multiple reasons why it's actually very appealing to people. And so if we as researchers create the tools, those tools could get widely adopted, but we have to build them. And actually as scientists, we haven't figured it all out yet, right? I mean, you know, people say, oh, everything's biased, but then, well, how biased is it relative to humans? Well, humans are pretty dang biased, you know, and why is it biased and is it fixable? Like if you're thinking about content moderation, you know, if you're fair to the publishers, you're going to be unfair to the users. And if you're fair to the users, you're unfair to the publishers and you can't do both. So you actually have to understand the context you're in when applying these kinds of concepts. You know, a little bit of education can go a little way, but also a lot of research has to be done in order to boil things down to actually have simple tools to be provided. We're not there yet. So the universities, we have this role. We've got to go do it. You know, nobody else is going to do it. We can do it. It's our job. It's our imperative, really. It's our obligation to lead in these ways. And then a final thing is like, this is general purpose technology. Like the prediction algorithms are general purpose technology. The safety tools are also general purpose technology. And so if we build them, you know, it can be used in lots of different places. You develop once and reused, you know, so there's huge scale economies. So it actually can be efficient for us to build this technology. A lot of this stuff is kind of cool because some things like you need a $5 million lab to do, where actually we don't need a lot of resources. And, you know, with a few grad students and a lot of hard thinking, you could make serious progress on problems that could impact lots and lots of organizations.
I love this. I love the emphasis on education too, because it just feels it's empowering in a way that, you know, when Mark Zuckerberg is like, oh, it's the government's job. Like it's not on us. I don't know. It feels like it's nice to have some agency in it and to feel like it's on us to be able to actually make a change. It does feel a little bit like using a carrot instead of a stick. And I wonder whether you think there's a role for a stick. And in my mind, that is probably in the form of government involvement or regulation of some sort. You know, so like it's like you can help on one side with education and educating labor to have good incentives when they're building out these AI algorithms. Should there also be regulation there, making sure and de-incentivizing people from making harmful automated systems?
Yes, but education first and research first, because these regulations can be counterproductive. And so we've seen this in finance, like there's many places where AI could be beneficial and reduce errors, but yet the regulatory framework hasn't caught up with how do you regulate algorithms. So they know how to regulate processes, but not algorithms. And the regulators don't even understand what the problems are. There are problems. Like if you change out a process for an algorithm, you've gotten rid of one set of problems and you've created a new set of problems. So it is actually dangerous to just let everybody go to town with these things. You know, you could have cybersecurity attacks on our financial services infrastructure that would be really bad. So I don't think they should just let anything go. But at the same time, what they've done instead is left us in a scenario where you have, you know, more unequal access to financial services, because one thing algorithms can do is they can help you lend to poorer people. But actually, the laws that are intended to help the poorer people can be counterproductive, because if you're trying to make everything sort of follow these old process rules, it may make it hard to have more complex algorithms that serve lower income people. And again, like from a safety perspective, you end up with more errors, more terrorism, more fraud by not allowing the algorithms to flourish, but be carefully regulated. And then on privacy, we've seen things like we teach everybody that a cookie is the thing that's going to kill you, you know, the worst possible thing. We have warning labels on cookies. So cookies are going to destroy your life. But if the solution to that is we only want one company, like if it's inside a company, it's great. Therefore, it's no problem if one company builds a super profile of you that spans across your browser and your phone and your TV and your watch and sees every single thing that you do pieced together into a complete footprint of where you were and whether you were in the bathroom during the TV commercial or not, you know, but that's fine, right? Because as long as there's no cookies, that should be fine. And obviously this legislation gets written and influenced by insiders who kind of trick people into going after the wrong boogeyman. Mm. So I think that, you know, there absolutely needs to be government guidance, but that guidance needs to actually be objective and reflect cost benefit instead of just being influenced by lobbyists for the big corporations that end up using the regulation as a barrier to entry. And in financial services, you know, we've seen that there's been a lot of these problems of trying to keep out new entrants and even, you know, economics, people are like, oh gosh, you know, we got to keep the banking system stable. So we don't want those young upstarts coming in. And you're like, well, okay, fine. Well, yes, we need to keep the banking system stable. Like, but how big a tax on the economy in the form of high fees and unequal access to financial services are you willing to tolerate? And if you don't have entry, then how do you ever expect the fees to fall? So I think that, you know, the regulation is crucial, but again, we have this imperative. The world is changing and the regulation is terrible and it's behind. It either doesn't exist where it shouldn't exist or it does exist and it's counterproductive. So we need to figure out what better regulations should be in a more objective fashion in order to have any hope of being able to get good outcomes for ourselves. But I do agree with the companies, though. I mean, it doesn't make sense for the companies by themselves to figure all this stuff out. It's not really their place to make these value judgments. Like, society needs to make these value judgments. But if society doesn't even understand what's going on, how can they participate?
I've spoken with medical AI companies that have received FDA clearance or approval, the standard for which might be retrospective validation on a few hospitals, and then go about deploying these systems nationally, and are not incentivized to do any studies that show scientifically that they're having a positive outcomes on patients. Granted, these are tough studies to do, but there's no regulation specifying these have to be done either. Do you see a possible structure here to create an incentive for disinterested parties? I don't know, just thinking maybe a set of companies whose job it is to just evaluate safety of other companies and then have a stamp of approval that is then seen by hospitals that are trying to buy these technologies as a mark of quality.
That's a great idea. And I'm actually thinking about a couple of ideas that aren't all even written up yet along these lines, some coming out of COVID and some coming out of my industry experience. So there are big scale economies, and in terms of data and also just in terms of expertise for a lot of these things that we need done. Like, we need algorithms evaluated for bias. We need cybersecurity health checks. We need ongoing evaluation of health technology. All of these things are things that have huge societal benefits, and not doing them places a huge tax on the whole economy. So ideally, you'd have specialists engaging in these activities, like if you could be dictator of the world and there were no incentive problems. But then the problem is, well, who polices the police and what are their incentives to do a good job? And, you know, are there entry barriers for them? Or is there even a market for their services if consumers are oblivious to the problems? So there's a bunch of market failures here. And I think that there's a couple of really great opportunities to invest in infrastructure that would enable dramatically more efficiency. So I think the cybersecurity area is one, you know, just huge externalities, negative externalities from this, just a tax on everything. And so if we could figure out how to get some more high quality centralized production of the security services that was incentivized, maybe it's, you know, a mandatory insurance where these are insurance companies and then the insurance companies bear the share in the losses. So therefore, they're really incentivized to do a good job going after the companies. But the companies also share so that both sides are incentivized. That's really important. Companies, one problem is they're under incentivized, but the other is they just don't have the capability and know-how. So it's not all of an incentive problem. That's why you need something more complex. On the medical side, you know, we saw in COVID, it was just tragic. In the first months, of course, now this whole thing dragged out. And so the urgency in some sense seems, it's like, oh yeah, like I felt like every week mattered when we were first shut down. But of course, weeks did matter because people were dying and the hospital systems were falling apart. And we had no data because the data is siloed in different hospital centers. And we didn't have a contractual framework to pool the data. We didn't have people sitting in the hospitals who had the time and data access to analyze their data in a way that then could be pooled. So during the pandemic, a lot of academics, including myself, worked on developing like common tools and methods and infrastructure. And what can we do? Federated learning, where we learn from lots of siloed data. We understand we can't pool it and bring it together. But it's 3 months after the hospital visits occur that the data gets pooled by insurance companies in a way that can be aggregated and analyzed at scale. So the US is flying blind for 3 months. And then even once it comes together, you don't have as much detailed data as in the hospital. So we're just set up to like not be able to respond to anything in any kind of short amount of time in the US, the way our data is structured. So you need investments in how data can be analyzed in a distributed fashion without sharing it. You also need, in some cases, pooled data that can be analyzed by states, like requiring everybody to contribute their data to the states or at the federal level, depending on where it is, so we can actually do this research. And then we also need more science again for, okay, what are the best practices for ongoing evaluation of drugs that were already approved, of technologies that were already approved? Find the right funding source for this type of work. How can we reduce the cost of doing the research? Because the data wrangling isn't something that has to be replicated over and over again. And how can we establish the best practices so that we have high quality refereeing and reviewing and high quality evidence presented? So those challenges are like just sitting there right now. We saw the cost of not having solved all those problems. I feel like this is a moment in time where we might be able to galvanize people to fix some of these problems and improve science and efficiency going forward. But those are public goods. So we'll see if we can get anybody to pay for them.
Love that. So we'll talk about causal inference next. I'm sure this has been an exciting time in your family with your spouse, Guido Imbens, now being a Nobel laureate. Congratulations. I watched the YouTube video of your kids discussing how scientists can draw causal inferences from observational data. So that was great.
Thanks. I think that was basically like the highlight of my parenting. That my kids got up at 2 a.m, made breakfast for the 10 people that showed up in our backyard, and were still cheerful and insightful by like 6 a.m. So
that's so sweet.
Yeah. So I think that basically I'm like, all right, can I just quit now? Can I just like freeze everything here? So yes, but that was fun.
That's awesome. I want to talk about the challenges of causal inference and dive into some of your fundamental contributions in the space, which I've had the pleasure of reading and using in my own research. The question I want to start with is asking, are there areas of healthcare that you see as being particularly well-suited for causal inference?
Yeah, so I think that picks up really nicely from the last topic where I was talking about like the infrastructure. So just backing up a little bit, like, you know, in healthcare, we have like epidemiology, where there's historically been a lot of use of observational data, but then there's also been a mix of high and low quality science. You know, we all know that if you drink 6 glasses of red wine and eat a certain kind of oil, that we're going to live till we're 150. And a lot of that kind of evidence doesn't really stand up. And then we have the RCTs, which is the gold standard. And of course, we have to have doctors, you know, understanding this, who are not trained in statistics, and we need to be really cautious about making mistakes. So there's been sort of this idea that a lot of research that's going to be published and really used for evaluating treatments needs to be randomized controlled trials, high quality randomized controlled trials. So there's a good reason for that. But in between them, we've just left this whole open space that just, you know, is so inefficient, because of course, You know, who funds randomized controlled trials? Well, a few get funded by federal granting agencies. A lot of it's funded by companies trying to get things approved. They, as you alluded to, have no incentive to follow back up afterwards. So like one of my COVID projects was trying to look at the impact of repurposed generics as potential COVID treatments. And it turned out that there just were not enough studies of those things because especially if they were generic, there's no money in it. And so we weren't actually going to do the studies that should have been done in that context. And then another point is that, you know, so suppose I got a drug approved on, you know, a bunch of 50-year-old white men in the 70s. What does that mean for me? You know, does the drug work for me? Who does it work for? Who does it not work for? So you can get a lot more bang for the buck if we had real serious evidence about how drugs were working in practice. Of course, all the other medications people are taking has changed since then. So this old evidence might not even be relevant anymore. So I think there's a huge opportunity to try to use observational data to complement randomized controlled trials, both to prioritize them beforehand and then to finesse them and personalize afterwards. This is where I think there's a huge opportunity for further investment. One other area is just trying to bring in all of the high dimensional data that we have, like sensor data. This is what I was looking at when I was looking at even the best like hospital EMR systems. Okay, fine, they might catch your temperature in there, you know, but most researchers aren't even using that data because it's more complicated to access and more complicated to use. And then there's so much more data getting collected. But if I wanted to study, you know, the impact of a COVID treatment and try to adjust for all of that, there's not really a good body of research to build on or a set of best practices to build on. So I think those are a couple of areas that come to mind right away.
I want to end by asking what the field of machine learning for healthcare can learn from different fields like statistics and econometrics, which you've been part of. You've been at the intersection of so many different fields. I know in one of your talks, you mentioned that to get an empirical paper published in econ, you might work on it for a few years, present it 20 to 25 times, and sit in a room with 10 people and discuss it for an hour and a half and figure out ways to break the model. That's very different than how machine learning paper is written. So I was curious what your thoughts are on that.
Well, in economics, we care about the methods and we care about the philosophy, but we really care about the numbers that come out. You know, we're very interested in getting a precise estimate of how much would increasing the minimum wage possibly decrease employment precisely. So that's one reason we spend so much time because people are going to actually use those numbers to make decisions for. And I think the early days of machine learning, people haven't really had to care about the numbers. You don't even necessarily care what the labels on your variables are. You know, there's Ys and there's Xs. Who really cares where the data is from? And that's great for incredibly rapid innovation of general purpose algorithms, but actually using things, you have to push them over the finish line. Like it needs to be credible to the decision makers. Now, do I wish everybody would go as slow as economics? Like we're terrible. So I don't think we should go that slow. That was a mistake by our profession, I think, to go that slow and write that few papers. But at the same time, some other fields have just gone way too fast, I think, and they're not slowing down to think about what the numbers mean. And they're not really trained to even criticize their models or interrogate them in different ways. So I do think that robustness checks and like generalizability, probably the biggest thing I would say is thinking about the data generating process. And actually there's multiple schools of thought, which often fight with each other, but I feel that they're actually completely aligned. They're just slightly different labels. So like Judea Pearl likes the graphs. We've also used diagrams historically in economics. We've also used equations. It depends on the setting, how we do it, but we take very seriously understanding where the data came from. And then Bayesians have always think a lot about where the data is coming from because the estimation approaches take seriously the data generating process. So I think whichever your school of thought, disciplining yourself to really think about where the data is coming from, to reason about it, and to defend it, defend why your modeling approach works, given the way that the data is generated. I think that can be really beneficial. It's completely essential in causal inference, but it actually is pretty beneficial even for like prediction too, because in the end, the world isn't stable and there's benefits to thinking about it broadly.
Love that. Susan, thank you so much for being on the show with us.
All right, thanks for having me.
And that's all, folks. A big thank you to Professor Susan Athey for talking to us today. And thank you for listening. We're your hosts, Pranav and Atriel, and until next time, stay safe and stay healthy.
The AI Health Podcast is produced and edited by Oishi Banerjee and Mark Robbins. Music by Ethan Achey. If you'd like what you just heard, let a friend know, subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify, or connect with us on Twitter at AI Health Podcast.